Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
I'm always fascinated by what motivates people.
Yeah, to see where they come from, really.
Yeah, yeah. And that, with Rachel, a very defining moment and decision about needing to buy a business and why that was going to be important for her in the future.
Yeah, I tell you, it's a great listen. It's entertaining, deep. It's brilliant, really brilliant. And the reference to Stevie Wonder, you have to listen if just for that.
Yes. The Stevie Wonder of...
Thank you.
Great episode. So, another one to record.
Can you believe all these years we've been doing it now? And everyone is a joy and always interesting.
It is. I marvel at how many interesting people
exist in our
little world of dentistry.
I'd like to say it's probably down to us, obviously. But no, I think we have very, very interesting guests who tell us lots of stuff about themselves.
Exactly. We get the easy job. We ask the questions and sit back and listen. So we'd sit and listen. So today, we are so pleased. We have Dr. Rachel Darby joining us. And Rachel is co-principal of the Chapel Dental Cosmetic and Implant Centre in High Wycombe with her husband.
It's a long title.
It's a very long title. President of the British Association of Private Dentistry, the BAPD.
I'm doffing my cap for those of you.
Came to life during COVID and a great contribution to dentistry. Young Dentist of the Year in 2021. She might have forgotten about that. Wow. But we just reminded her there.
Is that because she got older? Yes. She's forgotten it.
And also a mother, which is incredibly important. Welcome, Rachel. How are you?
Boom.
Thank you. And 2022, I just want to add.
Yeah. How old do you have to be a young dentist?
Well, if I said that, then I'd be giving away my age, Chris, wouldn't I?
Okay, that's fine. Obviously, you look very young.
It's very good makeup and skincare. And a big bit of Vaseline over the lens.
Yeah. I thought it was just pixelating.
I was just glad somebody still thought I was young. That's it. I'm taking it
Take it.
But it's in comparison to these two old duffers you are.
Yes, very young. Very young compared to us.
It's so lovely to be surrounded by such handsome men, talking to such handsome men about my favourite topic, which is me. And when they come in, you can tell them hello from me.
We think they might come in. I think you'll find they're in the back of the car. Quick, look over your shoulder.
That'd be terrifying.
That's going to make people go to YouTube and go, what's going on there?
So, to start, Rachel, before we get to your dental world, which is littered with success, including Young Dentists of the Year 21 and 22.
And 22.
And 22.
Not 23.
Before we get to the dental bit, let's go right back to the beginning. What was your childhood like, your upbringing? Where were you brought up? You got siblings, your parents?
Well, I had a very lovely childhood, and I would definitely have to say that because I know my mummy will be listening, so I'll say it now. Hello, mummy. Mummy Darby, that will be listening to this. So I was born and raised in Northern Ireland, but I have to say, very sadly, I have now lived officially in England longer than I have lived in Northern Ireland as of October last year. So essentially, I think I'm eligible to play for like the English ladies rugby or soccer team now. I think I'm eligible for that. And I have two older sisters. So we're a family of girls. My mother was a teacher, and my father, well, he worked in the prison services as a civil servant. And it was really a very stressful job. And it was really both of those, my parents, that really... Education was very, very important to them, and really they instigated a lifelong joy of learning for it. Mm. And I had a really happy childhood, absolutely loved my childhood. And yeah, that's essentially it in a nutshell. Nothing.
Whereabouts in Northern Ireland, Rachel? Mm. Were you Belfast or sort of more rural?
Very rural. So I was southeast Northern Ireland. That's a mouthful, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I was between Belfast and the border in a town called Banbridge. I wasn't too border country. I'm not like a culture.
Okay.
Yeah. Sightseeing.
I went on holiday. So I went on holiday once to Northern Ireland because I've got some friends there. And the lady said to us, Helen, she said, do you want rural? And we went, yeah, we'll do a rural. Boy, was it rural. It was like a cottage in the middle of a field with very cows. Rural. It was like, bloody hell, this is rural. I thought rural might be at least somebody near me.
Was your coming to England connected with studying dentistry, or did you come over?
Yes. I kind of felt I wanted to spread my wings a little bit. And, you know, Ireland can be very provincial and very small town thoughts. So my mother wanted me to go to Belfast or Dublin. But my sister was in Manchester, you know, it was very England back then, you know, Northern Ireland has changed throughout the years. It's now a very multicultural country. But back then it wasn't. And, you know, I was drawn to the bright, shiny lights of England, really. My sister went to university at Manchester and I was able to go and visit her.
Was that your sister that's the dentist or the other sister?
It was my sister that was a dentist, so she studied at Manchester, which is where I ended up studying as well. So my mum had a good bit, you know. She let me go to England, but I still had family close around, which, you know, somebody to keep an eye on me. And, yeah, I was just really attracted to the bright lights of Manchester and England in general, which was so different to what even Belfast would have been back then.
And Manchester's a really cool city. Were you and your sister at dental school at the same time but years apart, or had she finished?
No, she had finished and was out working and I went. So she's about 8 years older than me. So I really am a baby.
And how much of an influence was your sister's choice to do dentistry on your own choice?
It was a massive influence. I always knew I wanted to do something medicine or dentistry, potentially law or pharmacy. I did my work experience in a pharmacy. And disclaimer now, I'll apologise in advance, but I just felt like you were a glorified shop assistant. And so I knew that wasn't for me. Can we edit that part out at all?
Thank goodness this is a dental podcast, because if it was a pharmacy
podcast, any pharmacist listening,
I'm sorry, but that's how it felt in my 2 days' work experience doing it. We can maybe edit that part out or something. And then law, it is the truth. Law, I liked Ally McBeal. Do you remember Ally McBeal back then?
Oh, Ally McBeal, yeah. Yes. Calista Flockhart, wasn't it?
That's it. And then I was told it's nothing like that. So then medicine or dentistry. And medicine, you've got two ends to worry about, and stuff usually come out of the two ends, whereas dentistry, you only have one end to worry about, and nothing tends to come out of that end. And my sister, she did dentistry.
I like the very methodical science, but the logic to how you chose your career. It's to do with what comes out of orifices.
That's it, in a nutshell. And my sister had said, dentistry is a great career. It's, 9 to 5 and you earn loads of money. And I might add that this was pre-UDS, pre-2006 contract. So things were very, very different back then. And then, I took a chance. I did my work experience and I really liked it. And I have to say, hand in heart, I do not regret my choice of going into dentistry. It's a career that served me well. And, my daughter, I think she's showing a bit of a flair for a medical side with her little, she's only 3, with her little doctor box. And she keeps saying that she wants to be a dentist. And I'd be very, very happy for her to be a dentist. I really think it's a brilliant career.
Cool.
That's good.
So you came over to the bright lights of Manchester.
I was seduced.
What was your dental school experience like? Was it a good experience? Because obviously you've gone from being in kind of rural Northern Ireland to coming over to arguably the second biggest city in the country. A lot going on. It's a real culture contrast, and then you've got dental school experience in the mix as well.
Well, it was definitely an experience, something I did not expect. I was fresh off the boat, shall we say, which I was. I got the ferry over to Stranraer in Scotland and drove down, and I'd never seen anything like it before. So I was a little bit apprehensive and, a little bit scary. I went to school with 1,000 white people. That's what my upbringing was. We have to remember this was Northern Ireland in the 90s. Yes, there was peace, but it was a very, very different world. And, you know, a thousand white people. And then coming over to Manchester and seeing all of the different cultures, I was taken aback a bit.
Didn't even think about that. Yeah, yeah.
I remember seeing new people in, you know, the hijab for the first time. I'd never seen this before in my life. But, you know, you quickly get used to it. It took a while for people to understand me. There we go.
I was going to say, you rock up with a very Northern Ireland accent. Yeah, for sure.
I did. And I'm a posh Northern Irish accent as well, I might like to add.
I'm saying it must have mellowed in the intervening years. I can imagine when you first arrived.
I know, I kept saying, so it is. So it is, which I didn't even realise I was like saying. But no, Manchester Dental School was absolutely brilliant. I loved my time there. I made so many great friends. Hello, if you're listening. And also it was kind of... I went to dental school in 2005, so Facebook was just in England in at the end of 06. So also, you know, you're doing university at a time when social media has just really been born and brought to life. It was a very fun, playful area to be in, not what it's like now. So it was very, yeah, it was just a great experience. The teaching was great as well. And I really enjoyed my time. I think I enjoyed myself a bit too much because...
I was going to ask you, were you focused party or party and focused?
I almost failed my first year at a pass-fail viva because I was out drinking too much and partying too much, to be honest.
Okay. That was like acclimatising. That was your Manchester acclimatisation year.
I blame my mother. She never really let me go out beforehand. And then I went absolutely buck mad when I went to university.
Okay, so, mummy. Rachel is blaming
so
you now.
So you then qualify. And by today's standards, you then worked in the NHS for 7 years. And I say by today's standards because there does seem to be kind of trend amongst younger dentists to kind of qualify. And as soon as they qualify, they want to kind of get out into private practice and, you know, clear aligners and composite, whatever else it might be, attracts them. So seven years in the NHS is quite a while. But I'm interested to know, was that for you time well spent in seeing a real diversity of dentistry, honing your communication skills with patients? Because obviously you see lots of patients. Was it a good learning period?
I think it was. I was very, very lucky early on. I just qualified and I had a mentor in David Winkler, and he invited me to BAD, the British Association of Aesthetic Dentistry. And I went there for a few years very early on in my career. And I just, the type of dentistry that was on display was just so incredibly inspiring. And I knew that's, I might never get to that, those echelons and that type of dentistry, but that's what I want to aspire to be, and that type of clinician. So I always knew I wanted to go private because you would never be able to do that in the NHS. So I was probably the world's worst associate. I would take my time. I was always going on courses, bettering myself, and I would take my time and do that work. So I earned very, very little as an NHS associate. But it's difficult nowadays. You know, the NHS contract is very unworkable. But I feel time spent in the NHS is worthwhile because purely you're seeing so many people, you're getting to improve your communication skills constantly. You're getting to practice dentistry. You know, you're getting to cut teeth, you're getting to prep, you're getting to fill teeth, you're getting to communicate that with the patients that you probably just wouldn't get that sheer number just going in and doing it on the NHS. And I know I didn't have the confidence to go immediately private. At the start, it would just have been too much to me. I had still quite a lot to learn. I was quite green. And I think you are green coming out of dental school.
Is there an argument then that perhaps, I'm not sure when Rishi mentioned about the lock-in of some sort, that was just kind of a suggestion as opposed to it's happening. But would you think something of that ilk would work better where newly qualified dentists need to spend some time in the NHS, not necessarily to pay the NHS back, but to develop clinical and non-clinical skills so they're then better able to deliver private dentistry if that's their choosing in the future?
It's a really interesting argument. I think with what they're trying to say, because they are trying to tie them in, young dentists in, it has to be done fairly. Are you doing it with other professional degrees? If they want to do a case where they... Especially, you know, I was very, very cheap fees. I think I was the last year fee of like £1,500. It still took me a while to pay off my student loan. But if they were going to pay for my entire £9,000 worth of student fees, and every year they did that, I'd have to pay into the NHS, I would probably have done it, because I'd been from a background, I wouldn't have been able to afford that. And okay, you could be coming out with no debt after so many years, similar to what the army does. But you can't tie people in and still expect them to pay for it, not with the current contracts. There has to be a bit of give and get there.
I think you're dead right. I think if they could, that there's almost got to be a quid pro quo, isn't it? It's like with the medics, and it's like, you know, you spend that time, but there should be something. Well, we'll pay for you, but then the benefit of us paying for you is you have to commit to us. I think, yeah, it makes sense.
I think that would be very fair. Definitely with the price of fees now. And, you know, if that's just fees, that's not even living expenses. You're still going to come out with some loans. If they paid all of that off, I think people would. Some people would bite their hand off. But equally, if you didn't, then you pay the full fee. And then you've got a choice. Or you could go, I'll do 2 years and, you know, 2 years, 3 years not. And then I give this time to it.
Yeah. Which I think is fair. Yeah.
So, Richie, call me.
So then roll forward to 2017, you're now in private practice. And then rolling forward a bit further to 2020, you did your MSc in endodontics.
I did, with a distinction. Yes.
Well done, well done.
Thank you.
Important.
Do you, and you were saying about Dave Winkler and Bard, and was that kind of the start of this kind of idea about wanting to do excellent high-end private dentistry?
Yes, I knew that's where it's going to be.
And is that kind of a lifelong learning process as well? That's not like I do a couple of things and I'm there. Is that just something that's going to be with you?
It is, because I always feel it's never good enough. but he really did inspire. Like, he was very incredibly inspirational. I'm so grateful that I met him so early on in my career, because he really did set me on the right path. Because sometimes it is a little bit, you can get attracted to the money and then you don't want to progress. You know, you can be young, you can be earning an incredibly good wage and you just want that. Whereas I knew what I wanted to be eventually and where I wanted to be. So did the sacrifices to work upon that. So it's very thankful for that. And the reason I did endo MSc was because I was absolutely rubbish at endo, like god awful. It was so painful, and it wasn't without trying. I'd still spend hours on it, and you know, I would be there spending all of this time trying to do it, and then I'd be there taking my final x-ray and have my fingers crossed, and I'd be praying to the endo gods, and then I'd be there constantly with my fingers crossed at the computer looking at the x-ray, and it was absolutely the most rubbish thing ever, and you're just like heart sinking.
So to solve that problem, you did a master's.
So to challenge yourself.
Yeah. Like, honestly, Stevie Wonder could have done a better root canal than I was doing. It was that bad. It really was.
But clearly your lecturers didn't agree, because you passed out with a distinction. So through that period, you clearly got very good at it.
Improved.
Well, I improved my critical thinking. It's well, able to write about it.
It's probably got the most improved student. I thought they're not just a distinction.
Before we move on to the next stage of your dental career, did you always have an ambition to own a dental practice? As a young dentist, was that something that you saw would be in your future?
Absolutely not. I thought I was going to be happy being an associate. It really wasn't something that I thought about seriously until I was pregnant, actually.
I was going to say, when did it change?
Pregnancy. Some people say, you know, women go crazy during pregnancy. I'm sure both of you would not say that.
No, of course not. Definitely not.
I didn't go crazy. I went stoic. And that's the line. That's the storyline I'm sticking with for that. So my husband's also a dentist, and we were in a position where somebody suggested buying a practice to us. And I was probably about 4 or 5 months pregnant at the time. And then we thought, oh, yes, we'll be quite interested in that. And it fell through. And I think thankfully, because then COVID happened immediately. But it really got me thinking of practice ownership. And then I found out that I was having a little girl, and I just had a real sense that I need to be a role model for my daughter. You know, the role of women has completely changed. We're never going to go back to the kitchen and the bedroom and the homemaker ever again. You know, women are here, and we're here to stay, and we're progressing in careers. And I really wanted to show her that you can be a mother and you can also have a career, because I feel, and in my opinion, a lot of the time as soon as you get married, as soon as you can have a baby, you are somebody's wife and somebody's mother. And right, and the you disappears. And to be honest, I quite liked Rachel. I thought Rachel was great. I was with Rachel, you know, for 33 years at the time of giving birth. I thought she was fantastic. And I didn't want to lose her. So I find it, you know, it's really important to me to show my daughter going, you know, you can wear many hats. Well, maybe you could relate it to St. Patrick. It's on St. Patrick's Day in a month or so. And, you know, you can be the same person but have, like, different aspects to you, but you can be the same person. It's like that three-leafed clover.
I think that's really powerful. And also, I think it's inspiring for other women in dentistry as well. We were talking with some guys at the weekend, and they were asking about how many women own practices. And we said, actually, not as many as there should be, because there's an awful lot of young women who are qualifying as dentists. And some women move on to owning practices, but it's still disproportionate. Mm. There still aren't as
Especially
many female
there's
principals.
More in a percentage terms, there's more women qualified as dentists.
Men, yeah.
But we did also say we've seen that probably one of the biggest changes, apart from the age of people, is there are more women buying dental practices now.
Yeah, there is an increase. I think people like you and some of the other female principals out there do set a standard, and they show to other people what is possible.
Yeah.
Which I think it's hugely powerful. I think it's hugely powerful.
And are women owners, not women trying to be men owners. I think we were saying that sometimes we used to find that maybe the women thought they could only run a practice if they were like a man. But it was like, no, be a woman, because actually a woman quite often manages a practice a bit more sensitively maybe sometimes.
But sometimes it can be taken advantage of.
Yes. Mm. Yeah.
You know. It's always a balance. And I find myself, especially my younger days, I didn't have that balance. And now it's trying to keep that and be fair and still remain human, but to still have, you know, that authority. But apparently, or so I'm told, you know, me and authority aren't, I just have that natural authority. I think it's when I stand with my hands on my hips all the time. They're just glued there.
but isn't it funny how
isn't that fear?
I don't care what it is, it works.
but it's funny the triggers for big life decisions. You know, buying a dental practice, setting a dental practice up is a big thing. But the trigger being that you wanted to be a better role model for your daughter than perhaps you felt you might have been without being able to do that, to show her that you can have many facets to your life.
Mm.
Yeah, it was a really, really powerful urge. That and sausage rolls. Sausage rolls, I'd really like them during pregnancy. And then it was just, no, I'm making light of it. It really was, finding out that I had a daughter, it really made me.
So I thought you were going to go serious on the sausage rolls.
Sausage rolls, yeah.
Honestly, there was a great follow-up there when you were saying, oh, yeah, no, Greg's, they're top drawer.
They're good. Okay. I love that. Not those vegan ones, not those vegetarian ones.
Oh, no. No, I shouldn't make light. It was a very, very life-changing aspect for me, finding out I was having a daughter.
It's interesting that you felt that you had to be a practice owner to do that.
Oh, I suppose it is, isn't it?
I'm just saying, you know, you can be a super successful dentist and mum and wife and friend and all those sort of things. But in your head, you had that you wanted to own and run a dental practice.
I think it's also, you know, the future that a dental practice can give you. It's building up something from scratch and then selling it and providing for the future. So if anything happens, you know, my daughter has something to fall back on. My husband and I have said, if she does go into dentistry, I'm not giving it to her. She'll buy it off me or prize it off my cold, dead hands.
I tell you what's interesting is, if you look at that wall, I'm pointing at our wall that we have on, when we exist to change lives, to help our clients achieve their dreams. And that's exactly what buying a practice means for you, because your future is locked into that. Yeah, I think it's great, really. That's a brilliant advert for us. Thanks.
Thank you for helping me, to be honest.
Well, so I was going to say, so you had a failed attempt, didn't work, and then you did buy a practice, which is amazing. And yeah, we were very fortunate we were able to help you with that. So tell us about your practice. Where is it? What does it look like?
Well, somebody described it, and I've ran with it ever since, as a warm squat. So bear with me on that one. So it's already an established dental practice, but it was very much a failing dental practice. So the chairs were there, the reception was there, it was decent looking, but very, very little patients. So my husband and I, it's actually quite a distance away from where I live. I live in Brighton, and the practice is in Buckinghamshire, so between High Wycombe, Beaconsfield and Marlow. So I travel up and down. And it was a really good deal for us. You know, we saw the potential. We were very excited. We knew that we could improve upon the services, definitely with our skills. And, you know, it's a real challenge that we were excited about. But also it wasn't one that was going to financially cripple us. And especially when we were about, you know, it took a good 18 months to exchange on it. And then when we did, we thought, great, everything's fine. Reminds me of when I was about to get married as well. And then the country changed and Liz Truss happened. And then the banks, the interest rate went up.
Crazy.
Because
time.
When I was about crazy to get married, time. We were going to get married abroad. And we were getting married in Italy and everything was fine. And we'd agreed it. We thought, great, this is brilliant. And then Brexit happened and overnight it went up 20%.
Oh, wow.
So I seem to have that. Yeah, I'm just thinking about that. Maybe it's a curse on me or something. The interest
I won't
rates
ask you for your lottery
up.
Numbers.
No, don't. Interest rates went up, but it was still very affordable to us. You know, we're not overstretched as well, which is a massive sigh of relief for both of us.
Yeah. And are you both actively clinically involved in the practice, or did your husband support you with the business side and your clinical, or how does that work?
He probably pays for it, if I'm honest. Because he's a wonderful clinician and he has a job down in Brighton. And obviously my daughter's at nursery and she's starting school there in September. So one of us needs to be in that vicinity. And then I do the day-to-day clinical and managerial stuff. He comes in and tells us to do some things and we go, yes. No, we do listen to him.
I was going to say, do you then do them or just go, yes?
Yes. If they're a good enough idea, we do it. But he does have a very much a the background, the business side of running it. And we do have our meetings, like such as marketing and so forth. And then he doesn't place implants, but he will plan and restore implants. So we're trying to build that side. And that's his baby in the practice of it. But if I'm honest, I don't think we could work together. Right. I know it's a bit late saying that now we've got to practice together, but I think it's quite nice. You know, he comes up and does a little bit of stuff, but then there's still a bit of, you know,
there's a bit of distance, isn't there?
Yeah.
What's great is you're making it work, because a lot of people hear you say we live in Brighton, but our practice is in Buckinghamshire, which is like, hey, it's just crazy. But clearly it does work for you, you know, with remote management systems and other elements of how you run and manage your business, you don't always need to be on the ground present, yet you can get there. It's not that far that you can get there for a couple of days and work clinically.
Absolutely. Like I start at 10, so I miss out that terrible M25 traffic. And then thankfully I'm able to stay over two nights a week. So I do four clinical days and I have Wednesday off, because then I don't get to see my daughter on those two nights. So, you know, it's trying to balance the business, growing the business, but also home life. So I'm not just a face on a mobile phone for.
Yeah. So you've owned the practice for nearly 18 months?
Yeah, nearly 18
months.
So
what's it looking like now from when you took over the warm squat to where are you at now?
A gaping money-sucking black hole. No, joking. It is a little bit
excellent.
Bad.
Excellent.
No, it's, do you know what? I really love it. I absolutely love owning a practice and I've got my vision in my head and we're just slowly trying to build. And it did have a bad reputation beforehand in the community. So we're trying to build upon that. Oh. It's just getting slowly and steadily busier. And then when we've got, you know, some money and some, I would love to say a profit, but let's just say when we have some money, then we are trying to, redo certain things. So we've introduced the CBCT machine. We are in the process of, you know, just getting a new front door, because I think that will really help. We're going to have a glass one because it's an old Victorian building. So it's it's an old church as well. So it's like a solid black door. So we're trying to make it a little bit more welcoming and inviting. We've created like a TCO room and an upstairs lounge, but then we'll eventually try and redecorate that. You know, it's got carpet, so we'll take all of that out and, you know, kind of make it a bit more CQC suitable. And the last things to do are the surgeries. I'd love a new surgery and a new chair, but that's for me. That's not for the patients, to make the patients feel comfortable.
That's right.
So it's just doing stuff that are patient-facing, first of all, and just improving
upon
that.
But even so, Rachel, the things you've said that you spent money on, yeah, those aren't cheap items. You know,
no.
CBCT, you know, converting a room to a space for your team, getting your front door done. So
that's even a new door is expensive.
Yeah, I was going to say, so you're clearly reinvesting back into your business for the long
term.
As opposed to just saying, I want to get money out on day one. You're kind of saying, right, for these first couple of years, it will be hard, but we're doing it for the long term.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's a process, isn't it? It's a journey with it. And, it is, you know, you'll probably never be finished. It'll never be how I want it to be. But it's. I think it's about enjoying the journey.
Not getting too stressed about it.
So you're 18 months in. What's been the easiest thing and the hardest thing of owning a practice?
I think the easiest thing is the clinical dentistry, for sure.
It's what you trained for. Yeah,
that's it.
Especially as she's no longer Stevie Wonder of the endo world, which has made me laugh. I must.
I did have that reputation for a while.
Stevie, have a look.
Brilliant.
And then the patients always wonder when I put on the patient that black glasses, going, what's she doing? looking at me in horror.
Songs in the key of life playing in the background. Sorry, only those of you of a certain age will know that Stevie Wonder album. Brilliant album. Sorry, Stevie.
I'll just recap. So the easiest bit was clinical dentistry and the hardest bit was over to you, Rachel.
I think managing my time, managing the team as well, because it's a very small team. I only started with Erica and I was so lucky to get Erica, you know, and for her to take that chance to come and work with me, because you're trying to recruit people. And at the start, I was like, oh, I need to recruit somebody who's going to do everything. They're going to nurse, they're going to be receptionist as well. They're going to be a glorified cleaner because I'm a very, very messy person, which they will attest to. They will. My mother will also attest to that. It's her biggest disappointment in me that I'm not a very tidy person. So, you know, they have to do everything. So it's asking somebody to, you know, maybe take a chance on a probably a secure job, maybe not so secure, the fact that they were looking around, but, you know, a very 9 to 5, yes, we're going to have patients all day, to come and take a chance on a day that could be absolutely empty and we're trying to scramble for things to do for it. So I was very, very lucky and fortunate to find Erica, who's been absolutely amazing. She is very, very natural with the patients. I'd be lost without her, which I don't want her to know, because then she'll probably want to pay a rise with it. but she is such a natural with the patients, which really I find very complimentary for both of us, because she can be so talkative and she can find out the smallest bit of detail and information of somebody, where I hate doing that. And, you know, she could come in going, and so-and-so's getting a divorce and then this died and then that happened and all of this. And I'm like, how do you know this? You've been chatting to them for 5 minutes. And then it allows me to get in there and do the dentistry. It really is.
Yeah.
And then I took on Nagina as well, who's an excellent nurse. She really does put up with my messiness and gets everything sorted for me as well. So it's working in a small team and trying to show, yes, I'm the leader of the team and the boss, but also because we're so small enough, everybody has to work well together.
Everyone's got to muck in together,
I did hire... I got a bit panicked and hired a nurse too quickly, and I knew within a day of her working with me going, this is not going to work, and I had to get rid of her within 2 weeks. I just knew it wasn't going to work. So that can be a very, very difficult
fast
point.
Is a really important thing.
Yes,
it's a good lesson.
Thankfully she
people.
Left she walked out in a huff, so I didn't even have to do it. I was really worried. I tried to fire her and it was like breaking up with somebody. But you know when they go, I'm not kind of taking that for an answer. And they go, oh, I'll be
better.
Did
you say, it's not you, it's me? Did you do, it's not you, it's me?
Well, somebody told me a really good, it was Bertie Napier told me to tell her, you're doing the job, but not the role. And I said that, but then I just couldn't finish it and I couldn't break up with it. And it was it was like one of those really awkward breakups where you try to and then you're like, no, we're still going out type of thing. She was still there, but then got into huff the next day and walked out and sent me her resignation. I was like, I'll accept that.
Oh, so that worked well. Before you bought the practice, had you considered whether you had the non-clinical skills to be a practice owner? Or did you just buy it and thought, I'll just work it out as I go?
So we knew we didn't have the business skills. My husband had owned a business. He's more entrepreneurial than I am. He did window fitting before he became a dentist, and he had his own little window fitting business. So he always had, you know, that more of a keen eye aspect with it compared to me. I'm a bit happy-go-lucky, as you may be able to tell. So when we started it, we knew we need to act seriously and get down and get a business head on ourselves. None of my family have ever been in business or anything associated with that, so there's nobody to ask. So thankfully, I did a course with Rahul and Bhavna, and they changed my mindset. So my mindset was already in a way for when I was about to open the practice. And I really would recommend anybody to do a business course if they are thinking or they're in the process of buying a practice, just start doing it, because you have to think of a completely different way than being an associate. You really do. And they really were wonderful. I want to be Bhavna when I grow up. I hope she hears this. I want to be her when I grow up, because she is really fantastic.
Brilliant. And has it worked? Do you feel more confident and able to run the business now?
I do. And it's even just that communication, because beforehand, if you had a difficult patient, you would just be like, oh, no, send it off to the principal or they'll practice manager will sort it out. Mm-hmm. And now the buck stops with me. So I'm now getting to be able to run stuff the way I want to. And one thing I'm very passionate about is, which it took a while for the girls to get on board with, is if somebody's being rude or anything on the phone, stop them coming into the practice. I'll be more upset if you let them come in and have an exam with me, because then I have to try and get rid of them, than if you just stop it at the phone call and go, no, that don't speak to me like that. I don't think it's going to be suitable or anything like that. You know, it's giving them that autonomy, going, if there's a red flag or anything, please feel free to deal with it. Whereas I know some practices are like, never let a patient walk out. They always must be happy. If anything's wrong, then it's our fault and your fault, and we have to take that. It's, you know, it's changing that mentality with them. So you definitely, with communication.
I think it's spot on as well. I think it's spot on. Everybody says, oh yeah, the customer's most important person, or the patient's the most important. And actually, I think your team members are the most important people, because
Richard
they're
Branson.
The people that... Isn't it? It's because if they're not, if they're not treated in to the highest level possible, then you're not going to deliver good service. But also, they're not going to turn back up for work tomorrow.
You're not supported.
Exactly.
No.
And patients will pick up on a bad atmosphere.
Yeah.
Like, you know, everything, kids, things can happen. But yeah, it's just, they will
kids
detect
pick mom
that.
Or dad.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So like you need anything else to do in your life, you're now president of the BAPD as well.
Yes,
which is exciting. So what's the plan for your duration of
we
presidency?
Call that BAPT, like we did BAPT.
BAPT. It could be BAPT, couldn't it?
Yeah. Oh, I've been BAPT. I might try and use that now.
Yeah, you should. I'm the president of a BAPT. What?
I'll be BAPT. You know, I'm so fortunate.
Oh, very good. I see what you did there.
I'm so fortunate to belong to the association. You know, again, even that, because I suppose beforehand in dentistry, I was quite isolated, because it is isolating. And then suddenly I was in like the BAPD community. I was thinking of buying a practice. There's so many practice owners there that if you've got a question, you can email people or WhatsApp them, and you've got like a plethora of answers and people willing to help you. But I suppose for the future of BAPD, I think we really need to... It's the regulator, isn't it? It's just the problems that regulator throws up. It's just, oh, God, where do you begin to describe it? You know, we've just had so many people being struck off because of bank issues that the bank have admitted to fault, you know, with trying to register. We've had Smile Direct Club, and their remit is to protect the public, and they're doing no such of a thing. But they always just seem to be one bit beyond that law, don't they? So I think it's trying to get a fair regulator. I think that's what, in my presidency, I would like to, you know, we're never going to do it in a year, but to try and attempt just to show them, going, look, we are here. We see what you're doing. Come on. I want to poke the bear.
You want a balanced regulator, don't you? You want a balanced regulator, I think, as opposed to it never quite feels like that, does it? We're not clinicians, but
it doesn't. So I think, I want to poke the bear. I don't want it to be like the revenant.
No. but genuinely, what needs to happen? Because it's a two-sided thing, isn't it? I'm sure on their side they go, oh yes, but da, 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 and they've got their point. So how do you kind of make progress on our side, effectively representing the profession?
I think that the GDC need to understand where we're coming from and our issues. Like, it's not going to change overnight, but I read this fantastic book. It was all about mindset. And they did an experiment in the US, and it was actually in a hospital in the US, and it was on whistleblowing. And they had, like, say, the good team that they all love each other and they all communicate really well, and the rubbish team who don't, and they're all toxic and, you know, bitch about people and whatnot. And they said, you know, what's whistleblowing and where are the mistakes going to be? And they actually found that more mistakes were reported in the good team than the bad team. And they were very surprised about that, going, oh, but that's a bad culture. Surely that would be. And when they delved down into it, what they realised was that in the good team, they were willing to express their mistakes and explain their mistakes. And therefore, patient safety improved and things got rectified and there was like no blame. And they termed the, it was a phrase, the psychological safety net. And I think we are dying for that in dentistry because we don't have a psychological safety net, not with the GDC as the regulator, even the CQC and some of the things that they're asking for. You know, they're always pushing the goalposts, NHS England as well. Everybody's always pushing the goalposts with it. And I think it then makes us as a profession retreat in and become very, very defensive. Yeah. And then that's bad news for our patients. So if the GDC could do one thing, I think it'd be working within the fitness to practice and just having that psychological safety net to go, yes, there are vicious people. You know, you should be innocent until proven guilty rather than guilty as soon as anything comes in. It's, and I think that would help.
Bit like, it's a little bit like Matthew Syed and his black box thinking in the aero industry. If anything goes wrong, that failure gets shared around the whole industry. So everybody learns quickly and in real time. Whereas I don't think there's an open culture in dentistry where people would be happy to share their failures for fear of reprisal from the regulator.
I think the GDC just assumes all dentists are dodgy. That's sort of the way I feel in a way. The common denominator, you know, it's like the limbo bar is set so low that so many people trip over it. I find it really hard when you look at how they've supported, in inverted commas, the profession over the years. It's been amazing, really. You know, we used to work in banks, and banks used to do exception reporting. So the assumption was that everything was okay unless there was an exception. But it seems to be almost the other way around, that everything is not so great, which is the wrong mindset.
It's true. And, you know, the GDC there say they're there to protect the profession, but yet they let Smile Direct Club go. And then we highlighted it. They were like, well, that's outside our remit. And then it's like, oh, I'm sorry. What public and what patients are you there to protect then, if not that? It's not the act of dentistry. Yeah. But apparently for them it's not.
Frustrating. Very frustrating. On a more positive note, what does success look like for you?
Oh, well, my first thought would be like rolling around on a bed of money, but I suppose, you know, I can't say that. Yeah, one penny coins would be quite uncomfortable.
Imagine. Oh no, I was about to say something. I've changed my mind.
Doesn't have an E on this show. I suppose success would be contentment, to feel like, yeah, I don't need to do any more. I don't need to improve. And I don't think we're ever going to be content with our lot. There's always going to be something else to do. But I think, true success would be contentment. I don't need to earn more. I don't need to do more. I don't need to get more. I don't need to be more. I'm happy.
I think it's that sense of what's enough, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah.
What does enough look like? And then you kind of just say, well, okay, that's good.
That's enough.
You could always get more, but enough is still a good place to be.
Yeah. I don't think I'll ever be that.
No. Practice some chanting, some prayer bowls, or whatever. That's it. Those things where you let me.
Well, Rachel, we've got to the time where we need to ask you two incredibly serious questions. The first question.
Is this conversation not serious enough?
No. The first question is: if you could be a fly on a wall in a situation, where are you going to take yourself to, and who's there?
do you know, my first thought would be, I would love to be a fly on the wall on those like dental nurses forums. They can be so bitchy, can't they? But, you know, you have to be a dental nurse to get onto it. You just can't be like a little lurker. But my goodness, what you hear that goes on there, that would be interesting. But a more profound answer, I suppose. You know, I know I'm late to the game and I've just gotten into Ted Lasso.
Oh, yeah.
I love Ted Lasso. And I read a really good book about a year ago called Legacy by James Kerr. And it was about the All Blacks team.
It's amazing. And amazing.
I do love a bit of rugby. Big Ireland fan. Just beat France. What up? And just to hear their halftime talks and, like, you know, their, I suppose, their pre-game talks with, like, the coach and the manager, the halftime ones, how they, what's being said in that to turn their mindset around. I'd really love to listen in on that.
Yeah, no, that'd be fascinating. After you've listened in to the dental nurses forum.
And learnt the haka.
I know.
You should do that every morning in the office.
And our follow-up question for you is, you can meet somebody, you can sit down with a coffee, a glass of water, a big glass of red wine or a beer or whatever you fancy. Who are you going to sit down and have a conversation with?
You can't say Stevie Wonder.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. I love him.
Love
Arnold Schwarzenegger. I'm so inspired by him. I've listened to his autobiography, his new book, his Seven Habits. I was gutted that I didn't get to go and listen to him in London when he was there at the end of last year.
He was at the Albert Hall, wasn't he?
He's just such an inspirational figure. Again, his mindset. I'm very big into mindset. You know, I think Bhavna got me into that, so I'll blame her. But just, I always thought he's this big muscle-bound guy, you know, on TV. He's a Terminator. He was in Predator, True Lies, big muscle-bound idiot goon type of person. But he is incredibly intelligent. He's a self-made man. He was a millionaire even before he went into Hollywood. And he always had like a vision board going, that's what I'm going to be. And, you know, he got himself Mr., you know, bodybuilding. He was, you know, Mr. Europa. What's the big world one called?
Mr. Universe.
Mr. Universe so many times.
Yeah. And I think it's quite a bold statement, isn't it? For a solitary planet in a universe, to claim Mr. Universe is quite bold, I think.
But that's Americans, they're winning the World Series baseball.
Yeah.
Only America. And, you know, he just visioned that and it came true. And then when he wanted to be a movie star, he's like, and they were going, you can't do it. You've got a too silly a name. You've got too sick an accent. He's like, I'm going to be a leading man. And he did it. And then being a governor, he's like, I pictured it and I could see myself sitting in the office and what tie I was wearing and what I was saying. And I did it. And he was just very much a mindset going, I can do this. And this is how I'm going to do it. So really inspirational. So definitely, Arnie.
Hence the reference to I'll be bapt.
I'll be bapt.
I might have to get
that on the website.
I'll be bapt.
But I think you're right. And like you say, I think in the early days, people used to kind of scoff at him a bit when he was acting. Because
Conan.
I think when he started, the acting was a bit wooden. And he certainly grew into it. But you don't, you know, lead the world in bodybuilding, acting, and then become governor of California if you haven't got something special about you.
By luck, like, by chance.
Like, he'd never win an Oscar. He was never the best actor.
No.
He didn't have to be. He was perfect for the role.
He chose the roles that he was supposed to choose.
But also, he made Hollywood a lot of money.
Kindergarten Cop. I like that film.
Oh, it was a brilliant one. Well, actually, in The Terminator, he said he read for the role of Reese. And, that was the role that they offered him because it's the main lead role. It's the main male role after Sarah Connor. And he was just talking to them and he was like, no, it's actually the Terminator and it should be this. And then eventually they went, you need to be the Terminator to James Cameron. And he was like, no, I want to be a leading man. And they're going, you need this. And he just went, he said it felt right. And he said, fine, I'll do it.
Wow.
Brilliant.
And
brilliant.
It's made one of the biggest franchises, you know, cinema history. Like, who doesn't know
that must be one of his biggest roles, isn't it? Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Although I did prefer Judgment Day, I'll have to say that. I'm more of a Judgment Day person than
You're on science fiction here, Rachel, which Andy's not really in science fiction. I know what you're talking about. Andy's gone glazed over.
Yeah, I've heard of The Terminator.
It's a great film.
Is that a different film?
They got a bit silly, though, later on.
But Judgment Day, that opening scene, you know, in the uncut version, that was good.
Yes, good.
And then Linda Hamilton on her shoulders.
It's good. It's not quite all science fiction. So there's no aliens.
Right.
Well, No, there's not. It's just in the future. But don't even go down there. That's fine.
I think you've lost me. I think I'll stick with True Lies. I'll stick with True Lies. That was a good film, Jamie Lee Curtis.
You couldn't ask for more. She was brilliant in that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Was she in it? I don't remember.
Rachel, it's been an absolute joy. It always is. Whenever we meet you at an event, you're always so much fun. You've got so much energy. And I think you've just got a great perspective on life. That's really brilliant.
I love the fact that you've done the whole podcast with your seatbelt on.
Yeah.
Safety first.
I was thinking, I hope you're not driving, and I realised there was nothing moving.
No, but it's for a quick escape. She's a busy lady. Once we finish, she doesn't want to put her seatbelt on when we finish.
Well, there's marginal gains. Yes. Marginal gains. Right, bye.
A 1% gain. As soon as we finish, you can be on the way back to Brighton. Rachel, thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's been really good fun talking to you. Nah, not at all. Look after yourself, and hopefully we'll see you soon.
Thank you so much, guys. Take care now.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.